Hello and welcome to this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav. It was a surprisingly busy week in mid-September in the world of golf. And Rex, let's start first with the Solheim Cup and the U.S. team winning the Solheim Cup for the first time since 2017, trying to avoid losing four straight cups for the first time in tournament history. It was a week that began in Virginia with a transportation snafu, the likes of which we have never seen. And yet it ended pretty dramatically, as it seemingly always does with the Solheim Cup. Goes to show that that event is the LPGA's crown jewel, and it must be protected and promoted at all costs. What was your takeaway from the week that was at RTJ?
I'm going to push back a little bit. Transportation snafu that we've never seen, the likes of which we've never seen.
Of the highest order.
I'm pretty sure we've seen, if not just as bad, then I would argue worse. I'll go back to Kiawa a few years ago. It was not a pretty scene for anyone, and that includes the media or anyone trying to get on that island. And they figured it out. I do want to give the LPGA credit. It was a stumble. I think you and I both referenced
a stumble. They didn't stumble.
Whatever you want to call
they tripped,
it.
Stumble. They smashed their plant. They were bloodied. They were rolling them off of the curb. I mean, it was a horrible situation where you had fans waiting 2 or 3 hours just to get the golf course. I mean, there could have been tens of thousands who were turned away and just said, "Forget this. I'm not dealing with this." A PR nightmare, a failure from the top level on down.
And I recommend, I think both of us had the same take. We both read our colleague Beth Ann Nichols' column on this at golfweek.com, and she did a really good job of sort of breaking down why this was important and why this was, to use your words, a face plant. And I think that's probably a pretty good way of saying it, because this is an opportunity for the LPGA. Next week, or in 2 weeks, the President's Cup is an opportunity for the PGA Tour. The Ryder Cup is an opportunity for golf in general to grow the game beyond. We talk about this all the time, that we want golf to be a mainstream sport, but it seems like every time we start inching in that direction, we end up shooting ourselves in the foot, because this is a really good example of how were you not prepared for this. They've had big tournaments at RTJ before, which is on the shores of Lake Manassas, in case you didn't know that. They've had big tournaments there before. They know the logistics of that event. They know how to get people in and out. They know where to put grandstands. All of the things have already been mapped out. So I was a little surprised, but again, I was glad they turned it around. Probably my biggest takeaway, though, was the finish on Sunday. When you have a team, in this case the U.S. team, that has such a commanding lead, I think it was 10-6 going into Sunday's singles matches, it's kind of easy to say, oh, it's over, and to glance by. And it also was an NFL Sunday, so it's hard to sort of keep your focus, if I'm being honest. But give the credit to the Europeans. I mean, they made it a match. And at the end of the day, I don't think the final score is indicative of how close it actually got coming down the stretch. It's always hard when you're trying to dig out of one of those holes on Sunday, because you need so many things to fall your way. And probably the other part is, and look, I think this probably goes across the entire U.S. team, and we're going to get into a conversation about Stacey Lewis, but it's the emotions that we saw there. I covered the Olympics, and Nellie Korda was the focus of that Olympics. And everyone wanted to talk to her every single day. And I don't want to say the pressure got to her, but you can tell she had circled the wagons that particular week. She wasn't very chatty. She wasn't very emotional. She wasn't very outgoing. She was there with a mission, which I respect. And this particular case, though, you can see how the team atmosphere brought the best out of Nellie. I mean, for her to go essentially dancing on to the first tee on Sunday morning to open up the matches, that was so much fun.
Yeah, so many things to get to here. You mentioned the final score being closer than maybe the final score, or excuse me, the sort of the competition and the drama closer than the final score indicated. The final score, 15.5 to 12.5. But heading into singles, it was that 10-6 margin. Every time you see a 10-6 margin, like, that's golf's magic number, where that has been, that deficit has been erased on the final day before. It's never been bigger than that. And so your mind sort of goes to, oh, like, who could potentially close out the match? Where are some trouble spots? Do you front load the lineup? Do you save it in case things go haywire towards the end? Like, I think the 10-6 margin just never fails. Like, it almost always delivers because of the potential possibilities for Sunday singles. I would bring up first sort of this new look U.S. team. They only had a couple different returners from 2023, but it seems like they've certainly turned the page in terms of who is on that roster. Now, Nellie Korda is the undisputed alpha of that squad, but Rose Zhang went 4-0, didn't even see the 17th and 18th holes. It's the first time a player has ever done that on the U.S. side, just completely dominant, and certainly redeemed herself after what was a pretty shaky Solheim Cup debut that I covered in 2023. Laura Coughlin the Virginia native who went 3-0-1, has continued. I think she's probably the best, the second best player in the world behind Nelly Korda this year. You see the way that Lauren Coughlin has picked it up over the past 6 months. And Megan Kang, she to me is like that Justin Thomas figure that we've seen so often on the U.S. Men's side, the emotional leader. And then she backs it up with substance, going 3-0, undefeated for the second straight Solheim Cup. She isn't just sort of the spark plug, Rex. Like, she's also backing it up with great play, with clutch approach shots, with timely putting. I love everything about Megan Kang when you get into the competitive arena. What did you think of the discrepancy in the captaincies? The second time in the past 2 years that we've seen Stacey Lewis go up against Suzanne Pedersen, that Suzanne tied on home soil last year. Stacey Lewis, a pretty resounding victory this time on home soil, again, winning for the first time since 2017. What did you take away from her captaincy?
I love Stacey's captaincy. And again, this was a conversation you and I were having offline before we jumped on here. The idea that she leans so much into analytics. And I do find that fascinating because it seems to me on the men's side, certainly with the President's Cup with Jim Furyk, they don't have much interest when it comes to analytics. I'm sure they sort of glance over the spreadsheets and give it a good read or two, but it's mostly from gut. Like when I talked to Jim Furyk before he made his picks 2 weeks ago, it was he didn't have anything to throw in my direction about someone he might pick because of X, Y, and Z. It was always, well, how does he fit into the team room? How's the chemistry? What does my gut tell me? That's the antithesis of what Stacey Lewis did. And I think that's really cool. I think Suzanne, to be fair, Stacey clearly had the better team. This is like asking me, and I'll put it in terms that you can understand. Anybody that plays Georgia is always going to think that Kirby Smart is a genius. He's only a genius because he has the best 53 players on the field more times than not. I can't think of the last time that they didn't, probably last year's SEC championship. So I know it's still a sore subject for you. I know you don't want to revisit that, but I kind of looked at it the same way, not to dismiss the European team. It's clearly a very, very talented team. But when you look on paper, as we always do before these matches, the United States team is clearly deeper, has more talent coming off the bench. And in that particular case, Stacey Lewis did a really good job of maximizing that.
I mean, the European team did not win a single LPGA event this year. And so you can break down pairings. You can look at the data. You can look at who's going to go where in Sunday singles. You can look at wild card selections and who's the automatic qualifiers. The fact of the matter is, like, it still matters who is playing good golf heading into the matches. And it was indisputable what the Americans did. And I think we saw that with some of the player records over the 3 days at RTJ. This was basically an extension of what Stacey Lewis did last year. You mentioned how heavily she leaned into the data and the analytics. She's been sponsored by KPMG for, if not her entire career, the majority of her career, the data analytics team. She had our good friend Justin Ray, sort of in that backroom staff, who was feeding her information, who was sort of informing her pairings, who certainly had a big say in who was actually going to be on that team with her captain's picks. I think she and Stacey Lewis has changed the way Team USA views this. And you mentioned sort of Jim Furyk not being that heavy in this. I think there's clearly like a generational divide here. Jim Furyk, 54 years old. You look at Davis Love III, who's been in so many of these U.S. teams. He's 60 years old. Mm-hmm. Steve Stricker is 57 years old. Fred Couples is north of 60. And so I think
Paul Azinger being the outlier there in your conversation, yes.
Yes, but he was even younger at that stage of his career when he accepted the captaincy back in 2008. Like, there's clearly a acceptance of the numbers, of the data, of the analytics, of those insights that can provide that, quite frankly, a player north of 50 just really hasn't needed in their career. They did it a different way. And now when you see the captaincy, it's important to put players who are on the team who can sort of fit with the golf course. And Justin Ray, to hear him in an interview, said he knew that the bread and butter of Team USA was going to be 6, 7, and 8 irons. If we can have a team comprised of mid iron hitters, that's exactly what he wanted. He wanted to set the golf course up that way. If Europe had a bunch of wedges in his hands, that was going to be their strength, and he wanted to stay away from that as much as possible. I think that was certainly key. But I think it's even more important, Rex, from like an interpersonal and a social aspect, where Stacey Lewis was now able to share with her players the pairings that they were going to have, why they were going to have them, and why certain players would be sitting out. I think it's so important for them to have a reasoning as opposed to just like, I don't think you're playing good, or we've been using this for the last three or four cups. We're just going to keep sending them out there, which it seemed like Suzanne Pettersson has always relied on heart and guts and instincts as opposed to having like cold, hard facts of why you're doing something. And I think you saw that with the Team USA buying in. And on the opposite, you didn't see that for Europe, in particular, Leona Maguire, who has had a pretty forgettable 2024, but she played just one of the four team matches. And she tweeted on Sunday after winning her singles match that form is temporary, but class is permanent. That was a player who did not understand why she played just a single team match. And then clearly afterward was a little bit miffed at the lack of reasoning and sort of rationale behind why she sat on the bench for so often. So I think that just goes to show how important data and analytics could be, but also the captain and how that can really benefit the relationships that you can have with the players.
No, I think you're right. This is less about trying to explain to certain players why you're going to play here with this person or why you're going to go here in the Sunday singles lineup, whatever it might be. The more difficult part is to try to tell them in a way that's going to keep them focused. It's going to keep them moving in the right direction with the rest of the team while you're sitting out the Saturday afternoon foursomes session. I'll go back to, and they brought this up in the postgame show, Brandon Chambly was talking about the idea that the way Stacey was able to sort of check every box, there was not a stone that she left unturned. It reminded her of both Paul Azinger and our colleague Paul McGinley. And he went back to that Ryder Cup when it was Graham McDowell who was going to sit on Saturday afternoon. And he was actually playing really well. But Paul got in Graham's face and explained to him, I have to have you at your absolute best on Sunday because you're going to be in a crucial position in this lineup. So I need you to be fully rested. It gets the players bought in. Whether if that was true or not, it got him bought in and decided that, yep, this is what I need to do for the team, and I'm going to make the most of it. And I think she did a really good job of that as well.
Masterclass by Stacey Lewis. Again, I think it just oodles of pressure will be on Jim Furyk to justify the captain's picks that he made for Montreal, as well as making sure that the pairings and the order are exactly what he wants. Because I think you're going to see quite a different strategy from Jim Furyk next week at the President's Cup. Let's talk about the second biggest story of the week. That was Jon Rahm winning the individual championship on LIV Golf. Pretty compelling leaderboard, if we're being honest. Jon Rahm, Joaquin Niemann, Sergio Garcia, Brooks Koepka, all in the mix at LIV Chicago. It's Jon Rahm who wins, wraps up the LIV individual title. What did you make of this? Was this validation for his move? Does this sort of change the way that you view his 2024? Does it all matter? Where do you kind of fall on this?
Yeah, I was wondering where you were going to go with that. Like the second biggest story of the week could have been
it was not the Pro Court Championship.
It was not the Pro Court Championship. I was going to go maybe lean towards Irish Open, but I think I agree with you. I think it was Jon Rahm for the reasons you just pointed out, because we have spent all season picking apart that decision. And it was based entirely on what he did in the major championships, maybe a little bit of what he did at the Olympics when, of course, he melted down on that Sunday. And you start picking it apart. I still think there is part of this argument or part of this conversation that can apply to John, that maybe the move to LIV Golf wasn't best for him to perform at his best when it matters the most in golf. That's not a diss to LIV Golf or the PGA Tour. The majors matter the most. And as we've seen throughout the course of his career, he kind of likes to play with an edge. He likes to play maybe with a little bit of a chip on his shoulder, and maybe 54-hole shotgun starts and shorts with loud music isn't for him. That still remains to be seen. It's a pretty small sample size up until this point. We're going to base that entirely on what he did in the major championships this year. But when you watch what he did this weekend, and not only does he win the individual title, but he does it rather convincingly, I would say, with a really, really good finish in Chicago. And as I'm sort of reading the recap story this morning, and I think Data Golf is pretty much the only place we can go now. And he's squarely third in the world. When you look at it, he's behind Scotty and he's behind Xander, and they're all sort of right there close when it comes to the strokes gain, the way they do their strokes gain for the rankings. I was like, yeah, that seems about right. That as much as for the last year, we have tried to put our head in the sand and pretend like, oh, well, we have no way of knowing how they're performing on LIV Golf. We have no standard to compare this. I think that ship has sailed because, as you pointed out, it was a really good leaderboard. I mean, Joaquin Niemann has been a solid player all year long. Brooks Koepka was right in the mix. Bryson DeChambeau wasn't too far back. So you have to give hats off to John for winning that title.
I still don't buy the reasoning that the 54 holes, the shotgun start, the music, the shorts, like I still don't buy that that is not the best preparation. That's why John Rahm was a little bit sluggish in the major championships this year. I think it probably more has to do, Rex, with the venues that LIV Golf chooses and the locale that LIV Golf chooses heading into the major championships. I think that's something, if this is going to be you know, a part of our golfing lives for the next decade plus, that's something they're really going to have to look at to make sure that they're putting their players in the best possible situation to prepare for the major championships. And that's by playing difficult golf courses that are going to put a lot of stress on them, that they're sort of going to have to emulate the shots that they're going to have to play. Like, I think the caliber of fields now on LIV is something that you're no longer scoffing at, but going to these far flung locales like Australia or Singapore or Hong Kong or Saudi Arabia, leading them to the Masters, is probably not the best way to prepare for a major championship. Make sure they're playing the absolute best tests they possibly can. I do think overall, sort of 30,000 foot view of this, I think this is probably confirmation that we were too quick to judge John Rahm's season. Keep in mind, his swing was not in a good place. He had not won a tournament worldwide, Rex, since the 2023 Masters. And I think you saw a notable change in his performance, an uptick in his performance, as soon as he made the driver shaft change following the PGA Championship. You look at his results, he just finished the LIV Golf season 1-2-1, including a playoff loss.
He was also healthy. Let's put health in this as well. Yeah.
He was healthy. He didn't have the foot issue. Keep in mind, he's sort of couple that with the difficult pregnancy that his wife Kelly has had at home. She's sort of been on bed rest post Masters in April. I think it's impossible to say how much that affected him mentally, but we have a large enough sample size now with John Rahm's career to know that this was an outlier. The 52 weeks where he did not perform well is an outlier based on his career record. And so I do think that it played a large factor. This is the John Rahm that we've come to expect. This is the John Rahm who I would expect to play well in the major championships in 2025, regardless of which tour he's going to be affiliated with.
And I will say the story behind that, which I did not understand this morning. So the way it worked out is their relegation system came to a head this week. So Bubba Watson, who is a team captain, he was in that drop zone, whatever it is you want to call it. He should be relegated, but according to the small print I saw, but because he's a captain, he can make a compelling argument to the board of his team. And so my mind immediately went to, first off, who's on the board?
It is like his...
I have so many questions.
It was like his, it's like basically like his business partner. And keep in mind, Bubba Watson's Range Goats are among the more popular LIV Golf teams. Everything that I've read from our colleague Bob Herrig at Sports Illustrated and other venues said it's a mere formality that Bubba Watson is going to be brought back because of the, quote, compelling business reason to have him a part of the team. I actually did want to get into this because this sort of stood out about the LIV regular season finale, is that you did have regulation among the Vincent brothers. You had Bubba Watson, who's in the drop zone. Callie Samuja is going to be relegated. Brandon Grace.
Pat Perez was saved at the last minute. It was interesting, yes.
And so those players either have to go through the LIV promotions event at the end, where they're going to hand out a couple of LIV cards, or they're going to have to go sort of to the Asian tour and try and get back on LIV that way through the order of merit. I really think, and Bubba Watson's a perfect example of this, that LIV would benefit by being more transparent with these player contracts and who's up, who isn't, who has certain clauses in their contracts. Like, this is like being a fan of, let's say, the Kansas City Chiefs, and it's completely blind about what the player contract status are. You don't have no idea if Patrick Mahomes is signed to a 5-year deal or if he's going to be up in December. You don't know about Travis Kelce or Rashee Rice. Like, if you look at it from that sort of perspective, if this is supposed to be a team model, it's insane that there's not more transparency to know how much these players are getting paid, how long their contracts are, and if there is a possibility, like Bubba Watson, that you could be even brought back into the fold because of a business reason. It clearly wasn't performance reasons. He was one of the 5 or 6 worst LIV players this season. But I think LIV loses credibility, and I think there's sort of untapped potential. We look at this team model to not have the transparency that they probably should in this situation.
Well, and before I get at it, I want to point out, like, I want to give LIV Golf their flowers, certainly John Rahm his flowers. For all season long, we've been watching with a microscope, and he ended up having a pretty good season on that tour. The flip side of it is, yes, it's ridiculous. The point you brought out, it's the transaction. I think that most of us looked at least the model of LIV Golf and thought, yeah, I could be interested in that because of the reasons you just said. I have two really, really bad fantasy football teams, but it's the transaction that keeps me interested week in and week out because I'm never going to win anything. So I'm just trying to find a way to make this happen. In this particular case, yeah, I'd love to know what's Bubba's contract. And I understand bringing him back. Like, I'm not against that at all. He probably sells a lot of hats, if I'm being quite frank on this front. But I'd like to know all of these things. They could leverage this so much better than what they're doing right now.
Yeah, it's just so confusing, and it just seems like an own goal. Where if Brooks Koepka's got a four-year deal worth $200 million and Paul Casey's got a three-year deal worth $60 million, like, that's cool. Have that out in the open. Understand. Mm-hmm. Move the contracts around. Trade players for a 2025 promotions card. Like, who knows? Who cares? I think if LIV Golf really wants to get serious about this team model, more transparency, more openness, more accountability is something that absolutely has to come to fruition. One player, Rex, who will not be in Dallas for the team championship, who I did want to get into, who was clearly a focus of a couple of pods earlier this year, was Anthony Kim. He was one of the worst players on LIV Golf this year. His strokes gained numbered were minus 3.4 strokes gained to the field per round. That was actually better. He actually got better as the year went on. But if you look at that in totality, he would not have made cuts on PGA Tour, European Tour, Korn Ferry Tour. Playing like that, Anthony Kim would have been hard-pressed to make cuts on the European Challenge Tour. He was brought on to LIV as a one-year wild card player. Could be brought back again as a wild card player in 2025. Could, I guess, theoretically, sign with a team like Dustin Johnson's in 2025. If you're LIV, what do you do with Anthony Kim?
Well, you already missed the boat, I think. And this goes back to when he played in that first event. I believe it was in Spain, was his first event back. And you could have turned this into something really compelling. Because again, at the time, I think I called him Bigfoot. I mean, he had been sighted in public only in grainy photographs. I mean, the rumors about what happened to the legend of Anthony Kim had been going on for a decade now. I mean, there was a generation of golf fans who were really interested in, wow, what have you been doing, man? Like, where you been? Like, catch us up. Fill me in on what's been happening. And they did a really, really poor job of that. And like listening to some of the interviews that Anthony did sort of after the fact, I think part of that was driven by him. I don't think he's really in a place where he wants to talk about much of this right now. But that was the opportunity to capitalize on, let's be frank, you were bringing this guy out of retirement because you wanted more eyeballs. And that's what LIV Golf has done well in some circles at doing and then done really, really poorly at some circles. They missed the boat on it. You can bring him back, but I think sort of the nostalgia of Anthony Kim is worn on.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing how quickly people.
Well, he didn't play well. I don't think it's. Yeah.
That's the thing. I mean, he didn't crack the top half of any LIV event this season. His best finish was 36. We just went through the strokes gained numbers and how that would sort of match up on any other tour. Like, he was basically irrelevant on his own tour. And that's exactly what you don't want if you're a wildcard player. I think LIV is in a very difficult position because this is clearly a player who they brought out of hibernation. There was so much intrigue around him. He did not play well, but he seems, at least from the outside, to be doing all the right things. If you follow him on Instagram, like, he's clearly putting in the work, he's putting in the time. He seems to, at least when he's not making political posts, sort of saying how much this has impacted his family, how grateful he is for the opportunity, how mental health has been such a challenge for him over the past couple of years, and he's in a better spot. Like, it's hard to leave that guy out in the cold with nowhere to play professionally. But from a performance standpoint, from a results standpoint, from a credibility standpoint, like, it's hard to see Anthony Kim on a LIV roster in 2025. I applaud him for the strides he has made throughout the 2024 season, basically cutting his strokes gain numbers in half. But there is still so far to go from where Anthony Kim is right now to being not even just a top level player on LIV, just being a competent player on LIV. That's the hardest sort of transition to make. It's not from going to from bad to, you know, below average. Now it's from going below average to average or even above average. It's going to be so hard to do at his age with so much miles that he's put on his body.
Well, and to your point, I think everything that he's gone through in his life is an interesting story. It's a story that should provoke some sort of compassion out of all of us, because what he's gone through, a lot of it's self-inflicted, but a lot of it hasn't been. I mean, if you kind of go back, and this goes back to the story I wrote about him, his rookie year on the PGA Tour, he had a really, really rough childhood with a dad who wasn't a great person when it comes to being a dad. So all of those things you have to factor in, but you also have to factor in live fields are already so small. And the microscope is already on that tour for not really having the relegation and promotion that at least the world ranking feels like they should have. So to have a player like Anthony Kim taking up one of those valuable spots is probably not the best, let's say, optics.
Yeah, I mean, he can certainly be brought back as a wild card. It wouldn't surprise me at all if he signs on with Dustin Johnson's team for 2025. They just go completely DGAF. That remains to be seen. Again, Anthony Kim will not be in Dallas for the team championship because he is not part of a team. The third biggest story of the week, Rex, is Rory McIlroy at the Irish Open. Royal County Down completely shined. It's exactly what we thought. Like, this was a reminder that we need to have golf courses of this caliber on the professional tours year in and year out. Bring the best players to the best venues. It does not matter where in the world, we will tune in because it's so spectacular. But Rory McIlroy, as it seemingly has gone in 2024, was pipped at the end, just a crushing three putt on the 71st hole, hits the lip with his eagle putt on 18 after two spectacular shots. Was this more the same from Rory? How much do you think this one will sting not bringing it home in front of the home fans?
I mean, this one's going to sting for a long time. It's not going to be Pinehurst sting. I don't think he's going to be wandering around New York City with his earbuds in over the next few days. He's won this event before. I know this was going to be a little bit different because it's so close to where he grew up in Belfast. And I get there was a lot of heartstrings. And again, this goes back to what we did on the podcast last week, when my best moment of the year was when Robert McIntyre won the Scottish Open. And it was because it meant the world to him. Like, winning a major is always going to stand above, but for so many players, winning their national open really means something. You go back to Nick Hardy at the Canadian Open last year. I mean, that was one of the best moments of the year. So this one's going to sting for a while. I'm not quite sure if it's going to resonate the way the U.S. Open did. I will say that the most disturbing part for me is, and I'm not sure what I expected him to answer. Well, the fact he actually talked to reporters after the round is an indication of how this one's probably not going to sting the way Pinehurst did. But the idea, and he quote said, "I'm getting used to it." Now that disturbs me a little bit, because you don't want, no, I don't want you to get used to this. Like, this isn't what I want at all. You have to give him credit for putting himself in contention. And I see where he's trying to take the glass half full avenue, but man, it's tough. Yeah, I don't think anybody wants this year to be over more than Rory.
Yeah, just a really tough 3 months, just continually kicked right in the groin. I would love for Rory McIlroy just to have a reset, just to take like 3 or 4 months off of golf, reset, maybe make some changes. Like, Brandel's been harping on the fact that he needs to change like the top of backswing position if he wants to be more consistent with his wedge play. And that is such the biggest difference right now between Rory McIlroy and where Scottie Scheffler is. And there's just too much variance. There's too much volatility in Rory McIlroy's game, and making that change, according to Brandel, would be huge. To do that, you need to have dedicated time off. And I think Rory has, what, 4 more events in 2024, including this
BMW PGA
Championship, at Wentworth. And then, of course, he's playing in the made-for-TV event with Scottie Scheffler, Brooks Koepka, and Bryson DeChambeau in December. Like, I want to see a full-blown reset from Rory. I want him to go seek some mental help with either Bob Rotella, Julie Elion, whoever the case may be. Like, get him in the proper frame of mind to go absolutely berserk in 2025, because that's exactly what we want to see from Rory McIlroy this year. Again, a very disappointing situation with how it played out at the Irish Open, but that is sort of more of the same, certainly over the past couple months for Rory. Anything from Napa stand out? The final event, Rex, before the PGA Tour has the President's Cup. Mackenzie Hughes, Sahith Theegala, Corey Connors, all top 10. Max Homa missed the cut in his final tune-up. What stood out, if anything, about Patton Kizzire in his 5-shot win at Silverado?
Again, this is going to be piling on. Max Homa hit half his fairways for 2 days after missing the cut.
But he actually gained strokes to somehow the field. I mean, those fairways are incredibly difficult to hit. I actually thought that was somewhat encouraging for Max Homa. He was still in better position than a lot of his peers on that golf course. His iron play let him down. Terrible. He was 4 of 11 for scrambling and missed the cut once again. If you're Jim Furyk, he absolutely cannot see more than what, one, maybe two team matches over the first couple of days.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, you always look at Patton. You talk about trying to get mental help for Rory McIlroy. I did find it interesting, Patton talking yesterday about all of the things he's been working on. Probably the one thing in the 6 years it's been since he won on the PGA Tour last time is just mentally. He had to become a better player. He had to become stronger. He had to be more focused when he was on the golf course. And you saw that out of him, which is fun because you and I have watched Patton since he joined the PGA Tour, and there was so much talent there, especially with his hands or short game putting wise. But for him to go almost 7 years between victories is pretty shocking when you consider how much talent is there. And I always am interested when a player like Patton, and he said this, that he felt like he's been underachieving, because it's such a, like, it is such, you have to tiptoe around players. If you and I were going up to a player, and I've done this before and got my head bitten off, you just can't come up and say, have you underachieved? Davis Love, have you underachieved in your career? I asked that very, very early in my career and got my head bit off for all the right reasons. I mean, he was not having it. Most players are not willing to go down that road. And for him to do that shows how much mentally stronger he is. Probably the highlight for me, though, was Mac Hughes. Because I feel like from Mike Weir's point of view, the captain of the International President's Cup team, that was probably a bit of a flyer considering all the Canadians he had to choose from for those last kind of few picks. He probably wasn't the one that was standing out on a lot of people's lists. And so for him to have a solid week this week is probably a shot in the arm for Mike.
Oh, I completely agree. I think Mackenzie Hughes, not just playing at home in his first President's Cup, but sort of justifying or validating Mike Weir's trust and faith in him over a Nick Taylor, over an Adam Hadwin, players who potentially had better 2024s than Mackenzie Hughes did. I think this was an encouraging sign. Again, I still think Mackenzie Hughes was the right pick for that team based on his short game and his putting prowess. You have a couple of tee times ahead of you this week. You and I will be on Golf Today about 1 o'clock Eastern time on Monday, bandying around, no doubt, the exact same topics we just touched on this podcast. But tell the people at home, what do you have coming up for these next couple of days?
I ask for forgiveness and understanding, because when we do this podcast a few days from now on Wednesday afternoon, I will have played 5 rounds of golf between Monday morning and Wednesday afternoon. Goodness. I will be a broken, battered, sunburnt, and probably very, very sad man by that time. But I'm going out to Streamsong Resort, which is here in Central Florida. It's kind of hard to explain where people is. It's essentially right between Orlando and Tampa. I think you've been out there before, haven't you?
I have.
And so they have, well, they've had 3 courses out there, and they're all very, very good. The Red is my favorite, but they just opened up a new one called The Chain, which is a 19-hole course, and it's sort of a match play course. So there's no par, there's no tee markers. If you and I are in a match, we walk to the first tee, we play it, whatever the yardage is, and then if you win, you get to decide we can play the second hole from 90 yards or 300 yards and everything in between. So I'm really looking forward to that one.
That will certainly be a great trip. I'm sure you're paying full freight on all of those, those rounds of golf. I must say, Rex, the next podcast record is probably TBD at this point. On Wednesday, I will be in Stamford, Connecticut at our annual NBC Sports feature meeting, where we'll be kicking around some ideas for what you're going to see TV feature-wise in 2025. If anyone has any great ideas, anything you'd like to see TV feature-wise, if you're not familiar with what I'm talking about, we did a long one a couple years ago about Sam Bennett this year. Eric Van Rooyen was sort of our big one. They're the 6, 7, 8 minute long sort of college game day esque features that Tom Rinaldi became famous for. Please, sausage finger, put that down. If anyone has any good ideas for that, put them in the comments below. Find me on Twitter, even though I no longer tweet, at Ryan Labner GC. I'll be sure to find it. That's what we'll be doing on Wednesday. And we will not be recording, Rex, next Sunday or Monday. That is because I'm going to Buffalo, New York for the Buffalo Bills, Jacksonville Jaguars Monday night football game in Buffalo. Got a group of about 25 to 30 friends and family who will be eating just dozens of wings, pounding several light beers. It's going to be a great time in which I will surely watch the Jags go to 0-3. But please, the floor is yours for the final comment of this podcast.
Oh, I'd like to see an Anthony Kim feature. That's what I was going to volunteer. No? Can that be thrown
I believe, I don't think that one's going to fly. I also believe, wasn't Apple working on a documentary? about Anthony King?
There is a documentary being made by him. Actually, Sean Foley's brother, the Sean Foley, the swing coach on the PGA Tour, his brother does documentaries. And from what I've been told, it's completed and it's very good. They don't want to release it quite yet. Don't know why, but it will be interesting when it comes out. So yes, then if we're not going to do the pod on Wednesday, then be kind to me next time you see me, because I'll still be a broken man.
better than broken. Look forward to seeing you in Montreal. We'll have a full review of Joe Beef, one of the best steaks I've ever had. Ooh. Rex and I have a dinner reservation there Wednesday of President's Cup week. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lab. You guys know the drill. NBCSports.com/golf. We have so much on the website right now about the Solheim Cup that was recently completed, in which we touched upon on this podcast. Keep in mind the BMW PGA Championship. Also this week, the flagship event of the DP World Tour. We'll have coverage of that event as well on the site. All right. Thanks for listening. Thanks for the support. We'll talk to you guys whenever we talk to you guys.
2-0 this week.